Thanks to the organizers for inviting me and organizing what's been a really interesting conference. So I'm going to talk about something that just came out on Tuesday, actually, and some older work I had done. And so this will be about a real-time description of tunneling in false vacuum decay. Okay? I will hopefully convince you that the word tunneling is not necessarily appropriate when we're describing the actual decay of a false vacuum. And then there will be a second part of my talk in which I'm going to discuss some possible connections with cold atom systems for these false vacuum relativistic field theories. Okay. So just in case the title was being obscured by the video. Okay. So just a quick overview. Roughly, my talk is going to be divided into two parts. So in the first part, it's just going to be a pure relativistic field theory problem where I'm going to describe this new description we've come up with for how bubbles nucleate when you're decaying a false vacuum. And since this conference is about low energy physics and high energy physics, the second part of my talk will try and connect the two. And I'll describe an analog Bose-Einstein condensate system that you can set up to study these sorts of systems. And so I will show in the second part how exactly you go from the cold atom system to a relativistic field theory, and then some of the instabilities that you have to watch out for if you're not. So I'll start with a view of what I mean by first order phase transitions and this sort of thing. So I'm a cosmologist, and so cosmologists discuss false vacuum decay primarily in two different situations. The first is sort of the view of the multiverse, and the idea there is the ultimate theory describing the Earth, the universe, is something that's coming down from string theory or some other more complicated UV complete theory. What very often happens with these theories is you have extra dimensions and lots of degrees of freedom. So when you compactify them down and integrate out all these other high energy UV complete degrees of freedom, in a simplistic picture, you'll get a whole pile of scalar fields interacting with each other through some very complex potential. Okay? Now there's more ingredients to go in a full description, but the simple thing is to just think of a potential. And if I just take a bunch of fields and give them some randomly generated potential, there tend to be lots and lots of minima in this thing. Okay? And so what's happening is you'll have lots of complex evolution going on this surface, and there will be some evolutions that will stick you in a minimum. Okay? And then the question is, how do you get out? Okay. So that's sort of like the Uber picture. You can be a little bit more modest in what you're trying to do. And instead study a single field with some multiple different minima, some of which have higher energy than the other ones, and this is just the false vacuum. So this you could imagine in cosmology happening in the very early universe. You have some symmetry breaking phase transition. Maybe at high temperatures this minimum disappears, so you're stuck in here. And then you will nucleate bubbles and they will collide. And this is of interest nowadays primarily because you can generate gravitational wave signals that something like LISA would be able to see. Now, there are of course lots of dense matter systems where this is relevant as well. Supercooled water, helium-3. There's also protein folding tends to be described by some very, very complicated landscape of energy configurations for the way you can fold your proteins. And so the way that, so what you want to imagine is that I have some big chunk of space and everywhere the field is kind of stuck around here, okay? Now, if it was purely classical and the field's homogeneous, it will stay here forever, okay? Because energy doesn't let it actually get over the barrier and fall over here. Of course, energetically, you would like to get to the actual minimum eventually. And there are different ways you could imagine doing that. One is you could just come and kick your system, okay? Then you can fly over the barrier. You can also have thermal fluctuations or some other classical statistical fluctuations, in which case you can sort of fluctuate around this minimum and some rare fluctuations will throw you over the barrier. And the other picture that people usually have in mind is your fluctuations can be quantum. And then the usual picture people have is that instead of going over the barrier, what will happen is you will tunnel underneath the barrier, just like tunneling in quantum mechanics, and the bubble will just magically appear through this. And So the way that you will actually go from some homogeneous state stuck here to something sitting near the true vacuum is you'll have lots of bubbles nucleate and eventually coalesce and collide with each other. So just to be concrete, I'm going to focus on this particular model, and I'll get to why I'm using this model later. Most of what I'm saying is not specific to picking this particular potential. Okay. Qualitatively, things won't change. Specific numbers will. There are two parameters in here, basically. One is phi naught, which is setting the field scale over which the potential changes. And then this parameter lambda controls whether or not you have it. So when lambda is zero, you just have a cosine. So this point is a maximum. And then as you make lambda one, the maximum will transition from a maximum to a local minimum. And then as you increase lambda, the minimum gets deeper and deeper. So how do people normally describe the transition where I have a quantum mechanical state that's stuck up here and then tunnels down into the bottom? So the first thing that you do is you Wick rotate to Euclidean time. And you then make an assumption that, OK, you're now going to look for classical solutions to the Euclidean equations of motion. And you assume that you have spherical symmetry in Euclidean coordinates. And so what we're trying to do is some sort of semi-classical description here. So you're going to look for an equation, the classical equations of motion to expand around. So you try to solve this equation. And we want to describe false vacuum decay. So the eventual interpretation of the solutions to this equation are going to be that instead of this being the Euclidean radius, this is the radius of the bubble at the time that it, this is the field profile as a function of radius from the middle of the bubble at the moment that it nucleates. So the boundary conditions we need to put on are that if you're far away from the middle of the bubble, you're sitting in the false vacuum. Okay. And then this is just so you don't have singularities at the origin. Okay. So you can go ahead and solve this equation for various choices of the lambda parameter I had. You'll get bubble profiles that look like this. So when the minimum is very, very shallow, you sort of have, at large distances, you're in the false vacuum, and then you never. Sorry, the true vacuum here is always at pi, and the false vacuum is always at zero. You'll never actually get to the true vacuum. As you make lambda bigger and bigger and bigger, the minimum gets deeper and deeper and deeper as well. And what will then happen is you have this regime where you're basically in the false vacuum, a regime where you're in the true vacuum, and then a wall connecting it. Okay? And the relative width of this wall to the radius of the bubble gets thinner and thinner and thinner as the wall gets deeper and deeper and deeper.
You're supposed to think of this as the saddle point profile space, or what?
In Euclidean signature, this is basically a saddle point. I will get to the real-time description eventually.
All right, so lambda is going to change as a function of time? Is that what you're...
No. So lambda is constant.
Yes.
So you have some potential. Okay.
And what is the size of this bubble that's going to nucleate? That's that size?
That's set by wherever this transition happens.
So that just put tau equals zero, and you just solve the saddle point equation at this point. I can put tau equal to zero and just think of this as a spatial saddle point.
Yeah.
Okay. So sorry, for fixed lambda, the size of the bubble is the third?
It's fixed.
Yeah. No constant.
This has some solution if you fix lambda. That's fixing the potential. Yeah. All right. So the first thing you might want to get out of this is what is the nucleation rate for bubbles? Okay, there's a standard way to do this. So you have your Euclidean action. And you go look for solutions. So you have one obvious solution, which is just you sit in the false vacuum and it doesn't. Okay? That gives you some action. You have these other ones that are describing bubbles forming. And you look for states that have one negative eigenmode. The reason you want this is that you want the effective action in Euclidean signature to have an imaginary piece. So when you go back to real time, this will give you an imaginary negative contribution to the energy, which is describing the decay of your initial state. Okay. And so when you do this, you'll get some equation that looks like this. The leading contribution is this e to the negative si, where si is just the difference between the action on the Mount solution and the false vacuum. And then there's some contributions from the one loop effective action. Okay. So these factors here, you have translation invariance where you could have nucleated the bubble anywhere in space and at any time. Point in time. So there are one translation symmetry for each spatial dimension and one for time, and each of those gives a factor of root 2 si over 2 pi. And then this is the functional determinant with this is the functional determinant of the second variation of the action around these solutions, and the prime just means you've removed the zero modes from this bound solution. Yeah. So this is the standard picture people have in mind, and the key thing you need to compute then is this quantity si. You can go ahead and do that. What is much harder to get is sort of what this functional determinant is, but you can get an order of magnitude estimate that it should be sort of like whatever the mass scales and the potential to an appropriate power for dimensional reasons. And then there's some function that's dimensionless and should be order one. So this is the prediction for the decay rate from the standard formalism. And now you might want to ask, how do I get time dependence in here? I'm doing everything in Euclidean time. There's no actual time evolution. What does it mean? So your first guess would be you have this bubble profile. It's spherically symmetric in Euclidean signature. So when I go back to Lorentzian signature, that means it is hyperbolically invariant, or it has full Lorentz invariance. And so what this thing would describe is not a bubble nucleating, but you have a bubble of infinite size contracting, contracting, contracting. It reaches a minimum size and then turns around and expands. Okay, so this is not what you want. Okay. So what is normally done to put time dependence in is you just artificially say, I'm going to chop the bubble in half here at some time. Okay. I now have a bubble profile. I'm just going to randomly paste this into my space-time at some spatial location and as a Poisson process. Okay. So this is a very, very ad hoc way of doing things, and you have to assume the bubbles are uncorrelated, correlated with each other in this sort of thing. And the initial bubble profile is then given by the bound solution. Okay. So that's what everyone thinks happens. And your interpretation of this event is it's just like a particle tunneling through a barrier. It's a completely quantum thing with absolutely no classical description. Okay. So you might want to be able to actually simulate a full quantum field theory, time-evolving quantum field theory out of equilibrium, but that's exponentially hard, so that's not something you'll ever be able to do. Because we're doing a semi-classical expansion, you might ask what happens if the fluctuations around the bounds are large. Okay. The perturbative expansion you're doing here will break. Okay. More interesting things, you might actually say, I'm an observer who's watching this thing boil, basically, okay? If you are actually watching it, then you will get a history of, oh, a bubble appeared here, a bubble appeared here, a bubble appeared here. You could probably write down and say, this is the center of where one bubble appeared and the time it nucleated at, and you just give a list of these things. So you would like to have some sort of time-dependent description of what's going on instead of having to put it in by hand. You might ask, are there bubble precursors in your quantum state where you could sort of say, this is where I expect a bubble to form? Or given that I saw this bubble nucleate and expand, can I say anything about the quantum state around the time that it was nucleating? Okay. And you might want to ask, are there correlations between different bubbles? Okay. So this cannot be done in the standard formula. So what I'm going to discuss is a way to put these two things in. Okay. And so at some level, what you want to do is have a full time-dependent evolution where you're adding up and interfering full histories of the bubble forming out of the false vacuum. You get some complete time-dependent description. Now, it's obviously too hard to add amplitudes up for every possible trajectory. So I'm going to do something else, which is going to be a semi-classical description that's sort of based on the way people often do end of inflation dynamics and relativistic heavy ion collision. So we're going to start with our potential. Okay. And I'm going to say, OK, I have the field, and it's sitting in the false vacuum. So there's some mean value for phi, and its time derivative is 0. Okay. Now, how do I put quantum mechanics in here? Quantum mechanics is telling you that you're not allowed to set all the 4a modes to 0, because then you would violate the uncertainty principle. So let's just model those by saying there's some distribution of fluctuations that are sitting in here. Okay, so we're going to add some realization of a field fluctuations for phi and some realization of phi dot fluctuations. And we're going to draw these from some distribution. Okay. Okay, so we're going to assume these are both Gaussian random fields and that these are their power spectra. So these mimic Minkowski fluctuations, and omega is square root m squared plus k squared. Okay? So we've now turned it into a classical problem, and instead of solving the full quantum thing, we're now going to evolve these initial states just using the classical equations of motion. Okay? So at some level, quantum mechanics has been put in the initial state, and then I'm saying all the dynamics after that is a purely classical. Okay.
So, fixing these two correlations, spectra of fluctuations, does it fix the state completely? No.
No, so you're going too far. Okay. Okay. So you're going to sample these. So what you want is Fourier mode by Fourier mode. You will draw a delta phi. You know its amplitude, and then you multiply it by a Gaussian random deviate. And you just draw Gaussian random deviates that are complex with unit variance.
I guess my question is, at the formal level, there are probably many states with these properties.
Yeah, so you have to sample initial conditions. So you're sampling over full realizations of the field.
You only do that at t equals zero, right?
It's this is a zero.
Yes.
Just initially.
Yeah, I'm saying the quantum state of the system is not determined just by these conditions.
No. What you're doing is if you compute the Wigner function, you're drawing samples from the Wigner function. So the closest thing you have to a probability distribution. Assuming it's Gaussian. Yeah.
So this would be the exact state if you had an exact harmonic.
Yes. Oscillator. Yes. So, okay, if you start to probe out here, you might think that probably...
So, like, the tails of this distribution should be different in this...
So I would say there's one more step that has to be done before you can do things, and that is you need to weight each of these states you're drawing. So what you could do is just say, I'm still just going to draw states as some realization, but you don't have to weight them as though they're Gaussian random.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Okay. So when you draw these, okay, when you draw, so it's delta phi is, maybe I'll just write it. There's some chalk. Okay. So you're going to say delta phi k is okay, and then because you're on a finite lattice, there's some other stuff that doesn't. Okay. Where this is, complex Gaussian variable. Okay.
Yeah.
So, because you're drawing these as though they're Gaussians, this means that as you're sampling your field realizations, if it was exactly Gaussian, you just weight every sample equally. Okay. If it is not a fully Gaussian random field, then either you could try and figure out how to modify this procedure so that every time you draw, you can weight them uniformly. Or another way you can think about doing it is you're just going to draw things this way, but the weighting of each state will change a little bit. I'm not going to, the final result is going to be a regime where it's a decent approximation to say that it's quadratic for the fluctuations. Yeah, this is a true. Okay. Any more questions? All right. So here's a little cartoon of what you're going to do. You're going to grab some initial state, meet your computer, you're going to throw it in there. Now you're going to write some code and throw it in the computer too. And you're going to get that code to, from the initial state you had, just solve this equation. Okay. Now you're going to ask, what comes out? So if this was a really classically forbidden tunneling process, you would never see bubbles nucleate if you tried doing this. Okay. So here's an example of one single trajectory doing that. Okay. So the color scheme is... The color scheme is the field value cosine of it, so you should think of -1 as it's in the false vacuum, plus one is it's in the true vacuum. This is time and this is space. Okay, so we start here and evolve forward in time. And you see that a bubble nucleates out of this initial set of fluctuations, just using classical time out loop. Okay. So at some level, this is a classically allowed decay. It's not at some level tunneling underneath a barrier and some classically disallowed. Okay. So if you want, this is an existence proof that it is possible to make bubbles without having some like completely non-classical nucleation happening where you tunnel under a barrier. The next question you might want to ask is, yeah?
Just to see if I'm reading this correctly. So when I go up, that's time, right? So
This is time.
The wedge there is when the bubble appears.
Yeah, basically, this is sort of the nucleation event. And this is 1+1. So bubble here is domain wall, anti-wall. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So you have domain wall form go this way, another one form go this way, and in between is basically your... All right. You might want to ask, What is the rate of these decays happening? Okay, is it tiny, tiny, tiny compared to what you're getting from the instanton calculation that you've interpreted as tunneling? Is it bigger or is it the same? Okay, so to do that, you're just going to sample over lots and lots and lots of these initial field realizations, and I'm going to make one more assumption, which is that I can just do classical weighting on the initial state for the probabilities and not add with some crazy amplitudes every single state. Okay? And we'll see what comes out. So the first thing is you need to figure out when did my bubble nucleate. You want to extract a bunch of decay times and then try and fit an exponential to them. So a very simple way to do this, we're working on improvements to this at the moment, but a simple thing you can think of doing is suppose that your bubble was actually outside the bubble, you're sitting in the false vacuum. Inside, you're in the true vacuum, and there's a really thin wall between them. Then, before there's a bubble, if you take cos phi and average it over the entire volume, you'll just get -1. Once a bubble nucleates and starts to expand, then the average of cos phi over the box will just increase as some linear. Okay? If you just take this and plot it on a bunch of these trajectories that you've sampled, you will see that sort of you get this constant thing, and then it starts to increase more or less linearly, and then a bunch of complicated dynamics happens up here. So as a good proxy for when the bubble has nucleated, you can just say I'm going to draw a threshold over sort of the initial noise in my distribution, and when this average value crosses, I'm just going to call this a nucleation time. Okay? It's not perfect, but it's not too bad of a proxy. Okay? So you do many thousands of these simulations, sampling over the initial probability distribution. And you ask, okay, what does the surviving fraction of trajectories look like as a function of time? So if you're actually nucleating these bubbles as a Poisson process, the number of undecayed field trajectories will decay exponentially with time. So it will look like this. And gamma will give you a decay rate. So if you plot on a log plot, if you plot this, you see these are all basically straight lines. So now you just fit straight lines to this. And what I'm varying here is the phi naught value. So sort of the width of the well relative to the fluctuation amplitude. And you extract gamma. Okay? So this, at some level, doesn't know anything about quantum mechanical tunneling. It's a very semi-classical picture. But I also had a prediction for what this should be from the standard calculator. Okay? So now we can compare them. All right. So the orange are doing the simulation. Okay. So just extracting a decay time from doing classical evolution from sampling your initial state. And gamma over the volume is the thing that's invariant. And this is just some mass scale I put in. The blue is the instanton with the one loop. So there's this unknown function that's order one but dimensionless. Okay. And the dashed line is if I just set the prefactor to be one. Okay. So this orange curve and this gray curve match pretty well, I would say. And I did not muck around with the amplitude of this thing either. Okay. So the amplitude is both very close, and the slope of this thing at high phi naught values is close as well. And this is sort of the regime where it's a good approximation to say that you have a quadratic minimum that the fluctuations are broken. So this is where you kind of expect the calculation to work. Okay. So We have more work to do, but I think this is perhaps somewhat suggestive that this picture people have of bubble nucleations being a very, very classically forbidden process is not necessarily true. Okay. And I'll get to what else you can do with it later. So that's the end of the first part. Okay. Yeah.
That's a question. So we know that quantum mechanics is equivalent to the path integral. And in the path integral, you sample trajectories with a certain distribution. Whereas what you're doing is just sampling the initial conditions, and then you're evolving those classically.
Yeah. So what you're...
Why is that sensible?
So what you're showing is, okay, you could take the density matrix and do your Wigner transform to get the Wigner function, and then ask, how does this evolve? And what you're showing is sort of, if you take kind of these sampled states from the Wigner function, there exists a classical path that will connect it to something that has bubbles in it. Okay. I mean, a priori, you have no idea what this matching looks like. It's a very complicated function. And so you might think that because you do actually have classical paths in Lorentzian signature, these are stationary points, so they're probably going to be important when you do the path integral. Now, I haven't worked out the details of this. It's something that I'm working on. But this is roughly how you think it might work.
So usually the Wigner function is a complex distribution, no? In phase space. How do you sample it?
So we're assuming the initial state is Gaussian. So then it's...
Yeah, so isn't that already something not very physical?
So
in terms of what you just said about the Wigner function, that yes, the Wigner function is a... somehow well-defined way to think about classical evolution in a phase space, but on the other hand, it gives you a complex probability distribution.
Yeah, so we are not interfering amplitudes. Okay, so it is... I'm not saying this is proof that everything works out. Okay, there are a lot of assumptions are sort of going in, but one thing that maybe you think is going to happen is if you perturb the initial conditions a little bit, you'll still nucleate a bubble, but it will be in a very different spot. And so in some sense, your paths starting from these initial fluctuation realizations will diverge from each other quite quickly. And then sort of averaging over the quantum fluctuations around one of the solutions is not going to know so much about a bubble that nucleated over here. And then the classical statistics might work out for you. Yeah, it's a very interesting question to actually formally go through and see if you can demonstrate that the instanton calculation and the real-time one are giving the same thing. That's not done yet. Okay. But these orange dots could have been anything before you started, okay? So.
The blue and the orange curve do not seem to match very well in that direction.
So there are a few things going in here. First of all, you have to do a normalization between your lattice simulations and the sort of bare potential you're putting into the lattice, because the fluctuations are in the lattice simulations. So that's not in here. And there's an unknown function, basically a phi naught and lambda because of this renormalization that you've done. So, okay. That's one thing that could be going on. Another is, the dashed gray line is sort of like the very classical part. It's just getting the instant pump piece.
Just the exponential.
Yeah.
And then you feed
then, the then this part is the fluctuation determinant. So at some level, this is the quantum around the bubble. So it could be that this approach gets just the leading classical behavior and doesn't actually interfere the fluctuations properly. So there's a lot of like subtle complicated effects that you have to actually in detail go through and check before. But this orange thing could have been way down here and then you don't bother doing it because you know that.
It would be nice to do all the quantum simulation. I mean, once you go to the lattice, it's not.
It's real time though is the problem. You have to do real-time quantum mechanical simulations.
Finite number of harmonic oscillators is
trivial.
Doable.
with like thousands of harmonic oscillators. It's it's not like you can do 10. You do need thousands because you have to resolve the bubbles when they nucleate. So yeah, that would be ideal if you could just run an actual fully quantum simulation, but okay. I'm not smart enough for that. So. All right. So now the second part, which is going to be how this connects to Bose-Einstein condensates. And I guess at some level, this is maybe, again, there are details that you have to check, but this is sort of doing a physical system that knows about quantum mechanics for you, and you can check if this description that we have matches up with the description of the Bose-Einstein. Okay? So this sort of goes under the broad outline of analog systems. And again, there are condensed matter people here who probably know a lot more about these than I do. So okay. Just keep in mind I'm a cosmologist. This is many orders of magnitude smaller than what I usually deal with. Okay. So in terms of quantum field theory, analog systems have sort of been used to describe a few different things. So there's been a lot of work lately on Hawking radiation. And what this is doing is sort of looking at just the linear fluctuations around some background. So you just sort of need the dispersion relationship at some level that's supposed to be fully quantum. Another thing people talk about is looking at things like solitons and quasi-solitons in nonlinear field theories. So these are very nonlinear things, but they are also very classical. And so the quantum bubble nucleation problem is, because you are actually probing nonlinearities in the potential, it's a very nonlinear problem, and it's also supposed to be the quantum fluctuations that are driving. So it's kind of combining the two hard parts of these things. Okay, so there are two steps in having to make this connection. Okay, I'm only very briefly going to say something about the first step, which is there's actually something you build in the lab, and then you need equations to describe it. Okay. So I'm not a big expert on this. Next thing is you have a set of equations describing your condensed matter system. You then want to derive some effective relativistic field theory out of them. So this is the second step, which is sort of a purely theoretical exercise. Okay. So in terms of the first one, the kind of system that you have in mind is sort of you have two Bose-Einstein condensates that you've cooled down to very low temperature. And they're in the dilute gas approximation. So in that case, if you just have two separate condensates, they are supposed to be described by the Gross-Potevsky equation. And now you're going to basically shine a laser on them in order to couple them together. Okay? And so there's a set of equations you can write down where the condensed part of the wave function is supposed to satisfy this time-dependent evolution. Okay? And the things that go in here are basically, this is the kinetic energy of all the atoms in the condensate. This is the interactions between the individual atoms. And so you need to take the dilute gas approximation, because really there's some horrible potential in here, and you're approximating it as a delta function interaction. This is an external trap that you're using to keep the condensate from, you know, flying apart. And this is the effects of coupling them together. Okay. And you can write down a Hamiltonian for this if you want. Okay. And so, naively, this looks like it has nothing to do with a relativistic system at all. Okay? There's only one time derivative here. There's two space derivatives. Okay? This is a hyperbolic equation. It's all horrible. But lurking inside of there, there are, in certain situations, effective relativistic dynamics. And so the way you go about seeing this is we're going to rewrite this complex field in terms of a modulus and a complex case. Okay? And if you go open up a quantum field theory textbook and compare Hamiltonian to Lagrangian formalisms, you can think of this phase variable as a canonical position, and this is a canonical momentum. So the thing we're going to try and do is integrate out the canonical momentum. Okay? So when you have a condensate, the mean value of this rho is non-zero. And so to simplify the horrible algebra here and give you an idea of how it will work, I'm going to make the assumption that there's some mean condensate value, so this is just the number of particles, plus some spatially dependent fluctuation. Okay? And we're going to assume these are small so that we can integrate them. Okay? And I'm also going to specialize to the case of only two different condensates interacting, and I'm going to assume that these cross couplings between them are all zero, and okay, that the masses are the same. Just simplifying assumptions to reduce the algebra. Yeah. So now you can change variables, and the variables you want to go look at are the total phase, the phase difference, the total density, and the density, basically. Okay. You can expand your Lagrangian. There's a whole pile of ugly terms. The important things to notice are, one, your relative phase variable, there's something that looks like a gradient energy and a potential energy, okay? And then coupled to your canonical momentum, there's a phi dot. Okay? So when I integrate out my canonical momenta, I'm gonna get a phi dot squared. And so if I just go ahead and do that, I get some effective Lagrangian for the relative phase that is of this form, and there's in general some non-canonical piece in front of the kinetic term, and then a gradient term, and then a potential. Okay. So you can also tune this to be roughly one, and then you have basically a relativistic field where the speed of sound in the fluid is equal to the speed of light. Okay. And here you get a cosine. So this thing is basically the Sine-Gordon model. But what I told you was that I was going to get a false vacuum. So you might ask, how do we do that? Okay. So the amplitude of this cosine is being set by this nu, which is sort of the modulation amplitude coupling the two condensates together. So if we make this thing time dependent, i.e. we make the amplitude of the cosine time dependent, then you can do fun things. Okay. So the basic idea is you have a pendulum, and it's oscillating, and now you're going to make the length of the pendulum change. And you can stabilize it vertically so that it will undergo oscillations. Okay, that's the whole idea that we are using here. So this is just proof it's a real thing that can happen in the real world. Okay. So for simplicity, let's just look at the zero mode, and I'll put all the fluctuations in. You can write down the time-averaged effective potential. And this lambda is basically related to this delta, which is telling you the amplitude of the driving. And as you increase delta, you will generate a minimum here that you can use as a false vacuum. Okay. So once again, I have some equations I could solve, and I have a computer. So I can just put in the equations, solve them, and I'm going to use the same strategy as I did for the scalar fields, which in the Bose-Einstein condensate case is called the truncated Wigner expansion, which is you sample fluctuations in the initial size, evolve them with classical equations of motion, and hope that this is giving you something. Okay.
You make the new IJ time dependent?
Yes. So this is constant piece plus cosine omega 2.
The cosine in equation of motion.
This can cause problems. Yeah. Okay. So there are different types of evolution you might expect. So if you don't drive it with a large enough amplitude, then you're just sitting at a maximum. So you expect a bunch of tachyonic growth of the fluctuations. When you make it very large amplitude, then you will expect that the thing is trapped here and it will make bubbles, and then there should be some intermediate regime. So you can vary this delta, which varies lambda. And you can see the first case where it's a maximum, and just right away you have tachyonic growth of modes, and there's a spinodal instability. You can then turn on the amplitude of the driver, and you sort of go into a transition regime where it kind of looks like there's bubbles. Then you get something where it looks like there's very rapid nucleation, and you make the well a little bit deeper, and then it looks like there's well-formed bubbles. Okay? And here I'm plotting cosine of the relative phase again. All right. So that all looks great. Hooray. Wonderful. Okay. Well, I just told you I have some numerical result. You should probably be skeptical, as there's a dragon waiting to eat you. Okay. So let's not do anything physical. We're just going to say I'm fixing everything in my model, and I'm just going to decrease the numerical grid spacing. Okay? What will happen is you go from this nice picture where there are bubbles to suddenly there's a bunch of extra junk here. Okay.
Sorry, can you go back a slide? Yeah. Why are those bubble walls repelling and not annihilating?
So there's...
Is that an artifact of the numeric zero?
No. So what generically happens if you take two domain walls and slam them together, they tend to bounce off of each other. So there are actually two types of dynamics that can happen here, because there are two different ways you could have come out of the minimum. One is you can have the walls like this, in which case they will basically pass through each other and open up a new region. There's the one where they will fall to the same side and they bounce. But at some level, it's a collective mode, and it's hard to get energy out of the domain walls, so they tend to not just annihilate immediately. There's a lot of complicated dynamics that goes on.
Sorry, the Kapitza pendulum isn't just an upset thing that flips the potential, right? I mean, for example, it depends on the frequency with which you do the surf.
Oh, yeah, that's why. Yes, this is true. That's why the frequencies are.
There's some very complicated phase diagrams about the frequency and the amplitude.
Yeah, I'm actually going to. Yeah. It's very. That is why this is happening. Yeah, very good. I agree. Okay, so you might want to ask what this is. Okay, and this is, of course, linear instability is described by Flo-K theory. If I can go somewhat quickly. So what is the point? The point is I've added a time-dependent periodic oscillation into my equations of motion. Okay, and now I'm starting with basically linear fluctuation. So I will have, for the linear perturbations, some equations that are like, y is a vector, and its time derivative is equal to some matrix times itself, where the matrix is periodic. Okay. Now, it is very, very well known that if you ask, what do the solutions for y look like, given only this condition, you will find solutions of this form, where p is some periodic function, and mu is, in general, a complex number. Okay. So if mu has a positive real part, this means you have exponentially growing modes. Okay? And mu in general will depend on, for the case considered here, the wave number of the fluctuation, the frequency that you are driving the pendulum with, the amplitude you're driving the pendulum with, all these things. Okay? And if you want a simple example, I just solve x double dot plus constant times sine squared. Okay, so I just make this modulation of sine squared. What I'm plotting here is red. I'm plotting in color scheme the real part of this mu. Red means it's large, blue means it's zero, and you can see there are these bands of instability as you vary the parameter kappa, which you can think of as a wave vector, and alpha, which is the amplitude of your driver. Okay? So that's a simple case where there's only two fields. Or another place where this happens is when you're pumping yourself on a swing, the reason that you're eventually make the amplitude of the oscillations grow is because you put yourself in one of these resonant effects. Okay. So now the reason why I'm going to make these assumptions is just so that I have total phase and the relative phase phonons. Okay. And under these two assumptions, they decouple from each other. So instead of having to consider four coupled variables, it's just two that are wave number by wave number decoupled. So we can just ignore this. The effective frequency for the relative phonons has this form. So if I set nu to zero, then at low wave numbers, I get some sort of relativistic dispersion relationship, because it's just constant times h bar squared k squared. And then at sufficiently high wave numbers, I go into sort of a particle-like dispersion relationship where this term and this term develop. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to make this term time-dependent through the nu. And so if you ask, you can rewrite this in terms of some parameters A, B, and D. Okay, these are related to various properties of the system that I'll show the exact equations for in a bit. And now we vary these parameters A, B, and D, which you can think of as varying the wave number, the amplitude of the driver, and the frequency of the driver. Okay. So there are some modes that will grow exponentially like this. There are other unstable modes that also grow exponentially but have more complicated oscillating behavior. Then there are things that grow more slowly but still exponentially. And then there are other choices and modes for which the growth doesn't happen and they just oscillate periodically. Okay. So these are just some sample solutions that you get from solving this equation for various choices of the constants. Okay. And so now back to the Kapitza pendulum for just for a little bit. So that was taking the k equals zero limit, so homogeneous field. So if we do this analysis for the k equals zero mode, so particular choices of constants, we should find that if there's no modulation, then you're on a hill, so you'll be a tachyonic instability. Then as you increase the driving parameter, at some point that should disappear and you should have no growth. And then if you keep increasing, you'll probably excite fluctuations again. So just a reminder, this is what your potential is looking like. Whether you're on the blue, the green, the red, or the cyan curve is just determined by this lambda, which is determined by delta, which is the amplitude of the driving. Okay. And so what I'm now plotting is the maximal real part of a Floquet exponent. Okay, so if this is positive, you have exponential growth as a function of delta, which is basically the amplitude of the driving, and then some appropriate normal. Okay. So as I increase the amplitude of the driver, and the dashed lines here are the prediction you would get if you just did the potential analysis, so just the time averaging. The solid curves are doing the full actual Floquet analysis. Okay, so small delta, you get this tachyonic exponential growth, which is what you would expect, but then as you increase it, eventually, this hits a zero, which depends a little bit on what choice of this you make. And this is sort of where you stabilize the pendulum, but you can see that if you keep increasing it, eventually you can destabilize it. Okay? So there's some range where this will actually work. That's just the zero mode. Okay. This is a quantum mechanical system, so it's not just the zero mode. Those fluctuations are there no matter what you do. Okay? You can't set them to zero. So you should probably look at the whole thing, including the different wave vectors. What I'm doing here is I'm choosing different frequencies for the driver, and the y-axis is basically the wave number squared, okay? The x-axis is the amplitude of the driver, and the dashed blue lines are the prediction for where you should stabilize this thing just doing the potential analysis, okay? And the reason it's curved is that this includes, it's not just the wave number, it has some new input. And so where it's red, you have exponential growth. Where it's white, the thing is stable. So in an actual system, okay, you don't really expect the GPE to hold the arbitrarily short wavelengths. Okay, at some point, you'll see there are particles there. And trying to describe the thing as a field is not going to work. So there will be some maximal K value beyond which there's extra physics you have to understand that you will hope damps away things. And then the zero mode goes somewhere too. So there will be a little bar. And as you vary delta, this bar will move across this plane. So it'll be like a stick. And if that stick intersects any of these exponentially unstable bands, that band will grow. And it will, instead of having this bubble nucleation, you will have linear resonance that will eventually lead to mode mode square. And you can ask what happens if you start varying other parameters. Basically, the wave number of this thing is quite stable. So a key thing you want to ask is, what is the wave number where this instability kicks in? Okay. So suppose I've stabilized the zero mode. That means I've destabilized some of the higher wave number modes. Where does that happen? You can figure out what that is. There's an analytic approximation that is the yellow line. And the key thing is that it grows as the square root of the frequency at large frequency. Okay. So you need to make sure that your description of the GPE breaks before you get to up to whatever wave number is described by this unstable band. Okay? And to do that, you vary the frequency. So if you want to make the wave numbers that are OK bigger and bigger and bigger, you just make the frequency bigger and bigger. Okay? How much time do I have?
10 minutes, maybe?
10 minutes? OK. I'll very quickly say something about, here's a demonstration that that extra structure that was showing up in the full nonlinear simulations is actually this instability. So you can do two different simulations. In one, you're going to do a finite differencing stencil. In one, you're going to do a pseudospectral stencil. And so when you do finite differencing, what you do is you change the dispersion relationship of various Fourier modes. And so for linear fluctuations, everywhere you had a Laplacian in the equations of motion, you will, in Fourier space, replace it with some effective wave number squared. And the blue curve is if you use sort of a second order accurate one. And remember, I was saying that this Floquet instability kicks in at some characteristic physical wave number. Okay? So what you're doing by doing a finite difference stencil is you're matching the physical wave number to the numerical wave number in a way that depends on the lattice spacing. And as long as you take the lattice spacing to be sufficiently large that the unstable band is not part of the degrees of freedom you're simulating, there will be no Floquet instability. Okay? So you can go ahead and for some particular model, particular values of experimental parameters, you can figure out where the band is, and then you can map this band to a wave number, an effective wave number, and you can do different simulations. So the first is a spectral one, where Laplacian is actually equal to k squared. And what I've done here is I've taken dx to be just below where that band is. Okay? So I get bubbles. Now all I do is add on, I change dx by a tiny little bit, so I've now included that band and nothing else, and you see Floquet instability has destroyed this nice bubbly structure. You can do the same thing with a discrete stencil, which makes a slightly different prediction for what your dx should be. If you put it right below the band, again, you get bubbles. As soon as you include the band, everything breaks on you. And I'll just skip this. All right. So the key thing here is the GP is not valid up to k equals infinity. So you want to find a way to push these Floquet modes into wave numbers that you don't think are described by the GPE. And what you hope will happen there is that things like viscosity and noise will damp out the exponential growth of fluctuations. Okay? Now, whether that happens or not is like some detailed hard analysis you have to do, but this is roughly what you would expect. In the same way that in a fluid, when you start to take very short wavelength perturbations, they kind of see there are particles, and this is when viscosity becomes something. Okay? And so the key ingredient was that you want to change the effective frequency of the driver. Okay? And so when you're building one of these things, you have your equation of motion, and these two terms are basically set entirely by whatever atom you're using. Okay? So you have some discrete set of values you can pick, and then you can't muck around with them. The external potential and how you're driving the thing are determined by lasers that you're shining on the system. So these are actually tunable parameters. Okay.
So,
question. Yeah.
So when you're talking about the coupling, I mean, this could be a form of tunnel coupling actually between two separate condensates of the same species, or this could be a coupling between, you know, different internal states of the same atom and the condensate. What are you really thinking of?
Okay, so this is me not being an expert on this sort of thing. I would love to talk to anyone who can tell me more. So one thing would be you have two internal states of a single nucleus, throw it in a magnetic field, you get hyperfine splitting, and then you mediate the transition through some intermediate state.
So yeah.
That would be
tunable, yeah.
But the key thing to get this whole phenomenology is just that this equation is holding.
Yeah, yeah.
So any way to map an actual experiment into this equation will be.
Yeah, you need to find a way so you can actually implement the tunability of the new IJ in the way you wanted it.
Yeah, so the proposal was to use counterpropagating lasers with slightly different amplitudes.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Sure. Okay. So again, let's just model the wave number where everything breaks is like the cutoff on the lattice simulation, increase omega, and you get back your nice bubbles. Okay. So you might ask, what sort of frequencies do you need? So there's one scale called the healing length, which is where this transition between the relativistic and the particle-like dispersion happens. So presumably, this equation is supposed to be valid at least up to those wave numbers. Okay? So you have to make sure that the necessary frequency is above this scale. And if you want to go all the way up to like the S-wave scattering approximation breaks so that you can see the internal structure of the scatterings between the atoms, that is set by this thing. Okay? And here, m is just the mass of whatever the atoms are, so it's some number times the mass of the proton, and AS is the S-wave scattering radius, so it's some number times the Bohr radius. And these are parametrically different because it's a dilute gas, so this number has to be small. So you put in sort of typical numbers. This ends up being in sort of like the 100 kilohertz to megahertz range, and this upper bound ends up being in the gigahertz range. So at some level, if you want these proposals to work properly, you really do need to understand exactly where this bound is going to go. All right, I will stop there. So just a quick summary of what I talked about was sort of two things. The first was a new real-time picture of false vacuum decay. And the thing I hope you take away from this is that there are ways to make false vacua decay that do not rely on classically forbidden tunneling paths. Okay? Now, whether or not we have one calculation showing that this is agrees quite well with the quantum mechanical tunneling thing, okay. Whether or not that is true in general is independent of the fact that these paths do exist. Okay. And then another thing is, there's sort of these analog condensed matter experiments that you can maybe do, okay. There are problems where you can actually hopefully emulate this sort of decay process in the lab where at some level, the Bose-Einstein condensate is your computer. It knows about quantum field theory already. You don't have to find some way to get your classical computer to model that for you. But there are lots of things you do have to be aware of. And I just talked about one, which is a linear instability that you can excite by trying to make your false vacuum. So there's lots of work that is ongoing still. So we're trying to extend this picture we have for the semi-classical decay to really understand how it's related to the usual instanton calculation in detail. It lets, assuming it works properly, it lets you do some things that you can't do with the instanton. So you can study non-vacuum states, which are impossible in the usual formalism. We're also thinking about extending to higher dimensions, understanding exactly how these loop corrections enter. And then another thing you might ask is, I now have these bubble precursors that are sitting in the classically evolving state. What does the mean bubble profile right before nucleation look like? Does it look like the usual Coleman instanton? What are the fluctuations around that? And then exactly how realistic are these? Hold on. It's fine. All right. Let's stop there.
In the Coleman experiment you're proposing, how do you get that quantum computer to tell you the answer? What do you measure? You have to measure the relative phase, right?
Okay. So you need to measure the relative phase, which I'm told is possible. Is something I don't fully understand. But the key thing that you need to be able to measure is what is the relative phase, right? Because that is the scale of the
How do you measure that?
This I don't remember off the top of my head. I will have to look at it. Okay. So some sort of magic as far as I can tell.
But it seems like is it a destructive measurement though?
Yes.
Because that's extremely dangerous, right? Because you're doing something wrong.
Oh, so you're not going to get the full time evolution. You're going to get a slice. So then you have to do a slightly different set of statistics, which is if I slice at this time, what's the distribution?
Yeah.
But there should be a way to, if you make enough measurements, kind of stack them all together to get some sort of average evolution.
So did you try to test this method of starting with this random initial configuration, just evolving classically in just quantum mechanics, just tunneling in?
So it won't work there because energy conservation will not let you go over the barrier. There is at some level. That's not what's, yeah, but that's not what is causing the decays. So if it was just the tail, so suppose this was what it was, do the classical thing and just say there's a tail that's extending over the barrier and you have the phi dot too. So right away, you measure the energy. You will tell, do you go over the barrier or not?
Exactly.
That's a yes, no question. Now you wait M inverse, so it has time to go back. In that time period, either the trajectory will have decayed or it will not have decayed. And then after that, you'll get no new decay. Right?
Right.
So you will not get this exponential tail. Okay. It would just be like, there'll be some complicated dynamics here and then there'll be a constant.
But then doesn't that prove that it's not the same effect?
Yeah, it's not just that you're the initial fluctuation amplitude is probing over the barrier. It's actually dynamics happening. So field theory is different than quantum mechanics because you're really asking, does a finite region tunnel? Okay. Does a finite region at some level needs enough energy to get over the barrier if you want, but energy is not conserved in a finite volume. You have currents flying around. So there's no like no-go theorem in the sense that in quantum mechanics, it's just like, yeah, energy doesn't let you go over, but for a finite region in the field theory, you don't have this no-go theorem. And also, okay, the intuition is all based on the effective potential. That assumes that the field is homogeneous. When you make a bubble, it's not a homogeneous field. So at some level,
right,
the effective potential description is also not valid. So.
Other questions? Yes. I'm surprised that you mentioned that the modulation time scale is so high because it's basically orders of magnitude higher than any other scale of the problem, right?
Sorry, which time scale?
Modulation frequency, omega. In your estimation, you said it's...
Yeah, it has to be...
Compared to, like, the nucleus mass? Can you maybe elaborate why it makes sense that the time scale is so much faster?
The one that you need to kind of have the incident.
The modulation frequency. Yes.
So the regime that is being looked at here is sort of the weak resonance regime. In that case, you ask, when is a mode unstable? Which K modes are unstable? And it's basically, in fact, the way there's this yellow line. Okay. Maybe I will just explain where this yellow line comes from.
So do you have to think of like the collective energy difference between the two minima? Is it
if you want, the naive but intuitive picture is you have this, you're driving the field with some frequency omega, and you're producing fluctuations by the omega, just like donating its energy to fluctuations of the field. And so in this particular case, that's actually what the interaction looks like, and you're in the weak resonance regime. So energy momentum conservation basically tells you, you have energy omega, it needs to go into two of these fluctuations you're making. So the final energy will be 2 omega. 2 omega k will be the energy of the oscillator. And then to get the wave number, you just use this version. So the reason it's going like a square root here is that omega is like k squared. So that's basically you're driving it, and that driver is just pair producing. So it's frequency divided by.
As a remark, I think there was so the whole Hamiltonian everything sounds very similar to an experiment that was done in the Esslinger group at Zurich with two BCs on a double wall, basically. And then you couple the two with a very high modulation frequency.
Yeah, this is another thing. And then it's the symmetric and anti-symmetric state of the, yeah.
Measure the energy difference. And you can also look at it in real time. So that's actually.
Okay, cool.
Very clear.
I would like to talk to you about this.
Other questions? No?